Off the ball. This is News Talk.
Now then, you're very welcome back. So we are looking at the Sunday papers between now and just after 3 o'clock. We have with us two Sunday independent stalwarts, John Green, sports editor, and Declan Lynch. You're very welcome. Thanks for coming.
Joe.
So I'll run you through the headlines. First of all, you can imagine what all the front pages are. They're front pages of main sections, sports sections. It's Dublin, it's the five in a row. Brilliant picture here on the front page of the Sunday Times. Various players all sitting down and smiling and grinning around the Sam Maguire. The Immortals, Dublin claim All-Ireland Holy Grail as first county to win five in a row. 118 to 15 points if you somehow missed the scoreline. And just worth mentioning here, very bottom left-hand side, Henshaw, a doubt for World Cup. Speculation growing last night. Robbie Henshaw could be ruled out of the World Cup with injury. Leinster centre was expected to start in Ireland's opening game of the tournament. He is reported to have suffered a hamstring tear. To be confirmed, very much so. But that is on the front page of the Sunday Times, 26 years old. Robbie Henshaw reported to have suffered a hamstring tear, TBC. Front page of the Sunday Independent sports section. Well, there's two front pages. There's this wraparound section on the ladies' All-Ireland final day. Brilliant pictures of the six captains involved. And Dermot Crowe here on the front page. Galway returned to final in bid to halt Dublin's tilt at third successive title. And then inside that on the main sports section front page, as you can imagine, it's the Dubs again. This time it's Brian Fenton lifting the Sam Maguire. The pictures last night are all brilliant. The lighting was just beautiful at times. Dublin's high five, history is made through most unlikely of heroes as Merchant seals win with breakaway goal. That's the front page of the Sunday Independent. And then as you can see, it's front page and back page news. The Sun, high five, Cluxton leads Dubs to historic victory. And then back page, that same picture in the Sunday Independent, it's Brian Fenton. Five alive-o, the headline, Kieran, that's Kilkenny, it's so special. Sunday World, front page, Dubs again. History makers, Dubs first team to win five in a row in GAA history. And then back page, just various pictures. There's one of Merchant and Johnny Cooper and Jim McConley. There's Stephen Cluxton lifting the Sam Maguire. We have Keane O'Sullivan here and James McCarthy. So pictures are plenty across the back pages. Next to the Mail, Blutopia is their headline. Dublin cement their place as the greatest of all time after sealing fifth straight All-Ireland win. And then the Mirror finally, all Gav a shot at six. This is the big question, isn't it? What Jim Gavin intends to do. So the Mirror interpret Jim Gavin's press conference as a big hint that he will stay on. Boss Jim Gavin added to Dublin's joy last night with a broad hint that he'll be back for a shot at six in a row. Gavin said he'll take time to reflect but indicated he's going nowhere. They say here in the Mirror, when he was asked if it feels like the end, he said, no, I can't say it does for me. I've committed to next year, so we'll reflect in a couple of days. So that was Jim Gavin last night. And again, the Robbie Henshaw story robbed. Picture of Henshaw looking downcast. Robbie Henshaw, World Cup fears. A huge doubt, they say, for Ireland's World Cup opener. Henshaw, 26, has a hamstring issue that could rule him out. But no, nothing more specific than that. So there we are. They are the front and back pages. All-Ireland final. John Green, where do you want to start?
Where do I want to start? I think it's an unusual one because a Saturday night game is unusual for the Sunday paper. It's a game of such magnitude that I believe even Declan Lynch might have watched some of it. But the across the papers, the ability and the talent of the team of writers who were in Croke Park last night to produce the copy that they've produced today under the strictest of deadlines. It's something that you don't sometimes appreciate when, you know, when you pick up your paper on a Sunday morning, as I hope people are doing today, and they look across at the Sunday Times, Sunday World, Sunday Independent, the Mail and Sunday, all the papers, and the ability and the talent of the writers to produce pieces of copy in literally 35, 40 minutes after the game. It's just something I'd like to flag because it's not something that you know, you necessarily think about. You just open the paper and you assume it's there.
Yeah.
But the actual the logistics of getting it to that point. I mean, for us to get last night to get some coverage of the match into our UK edition, we had 7 minutes after the final whistle to get it in, to get it over, or it would miss the paper would miss the trucks over there. So it's that tight of an operation sometimes.
A brief tangent. Why with technology is it 7 minutes? Why is there not some uber-fast printing mechanism that has made all this very, very easy? Why is it not 2 a.m.?
The uber-fast printing mechanism gave us the 7 minutes. It would have been worse in the olden days because the trucks still have to leave and the UK is, you know, yeah, fair size. And it's not just the Sunday Independent that was going to be in the back of that truck. It's going to be a lot of other newspapers as well. Mm. So you get your slot and we print directly in the UK. You have your slot and you can't miss it because the next slot is taken. So it's just that whole logistical operation of getting the paper out to people in this online age.
Eamon Sweeney on page 5. The headline is, "It's time to end the begrudgery and accept that the future remains. No team deserved to win the 5 in a row more than Sky Blues." He says at one point, "It's time to end the begrudgery and give Jim Gavin's team its due. Quibbles about who got what funding when and pointless demographic arguments seem unbelievably petty when set against the achievements of this side." I don't think they're probably mutually exclusive. I think you can have misgivings about the funding and the demographics, but also applaud this side. But he's making that point that the begrudgery shouldn't dominate how we view this achievement. And he said, "The weaknesses which Kerry managed to camouflage the first day out undid them the second time out. In the semi-finals, it looked unlikely their full back line would be able to contain Mannion and O'Callaghan. Having somehow managed to do it in the drawn game, they were badly exposed in this area, with the duo landing 4 points each from play. The future does not belong to Kerry. It belongs to Dublin as long as they can maintain their focus and hunger." And then he goes on to say, "As a great a manager as Brian Cody and Mick O'Dwyer, Gavin has been monstrously underrated. You feel he'd be quite happy with that. Yet the one change he made yesterday, bringing in Merchant for Michael Darren McCauley, proved as clear a masterstroke as you could wish for." He finishes his piece by saying, "The Dubs, we've been lucky to have them."
Yeah. Yeah, I think misgivings is a good word. I think you can have misgivings about the funding and what it has created, but you cannot take away from what Dublin have achieved. I mean, I'm not as convinced on the funding argument. I know it is important, but I'm not as convinced about it because, you know, funding, as we see in the Premier League, can be thrown at pretty much anything and not achieve any outcomes. What Dublin have done over the last 15 years is an extraordinary thing, and it's not just their Gaelic football team. Their hurling team has risen, their ladies football team has risen, their camogie team is rising. Mm. So it has been across the board. Their clubs have improved. So it hasn't just been, this is the pinnacle of it, if you like, for the first men's team to win a 5 in a row in the history of the GAA. May not happen again. There's every chance it won't. The only thing I disagree with Eamon there is his assertion that Kerry, the future does not belong to Kerry. I think watching that game yesterday, there's nobody that would think that that Kerry team will not win in All-Ireland in the next few years. It's unthinkable, actually, at this point to think that.
Yeah, actually, Tommy Conlon, another really excellent piece, again, done at very short notice, but he's on about the fact that Jim Gavin it'll be immensely satisfying for him, his staff and his players, that they were made to earn this landmark achievement the hard way. They were sent down deep into the salt water to find the silver and bring it back to the surface. Is an excellent line, really. So, you know, I guess there was that sense that they were given a proper game and all that. But it is this fascinating thing you find in all sports, that if a team establishes this dominance, even psychological or whatever, there's this almost invisible barrier to the challengers, you know, that Kerry should have won the first match by any normal. You know, they just didn't, because for some reason they couldn't win, you know. It's a really extraordinarily difficult thing to understand, that thing, and yet you see it again and again and again. Like, one of the remarkable things about the Norwich and City yesterday, well, that was classically one of those matches where, you know, City obviously will win, you know, eventually, and yet they didn't. So it's such a shock when it doesn't happen. Right, so Dublin now have that, clearly. They have that thing whereby even if a team is actually sort of better than them on the day, they'll still win. And that's an indefinable thing. You know.
In the win, and Eamon pointed out, and it was only when I was working on the piece last night, he makes a point in it that, and what history will show is that in Dublin's run of All-Ireland successes in the last decade, this was their second biggest winning margin. You know, so that's what history will show. I mean, we saw a great game last night, but ultimately we saw pretty convincing winners in the end. That was the first thing that struck me. And the second thing that struck me last night, you know, in the heat of the moment with the game, was really this game, that game last night was won in the last 13 minutes of the drawn game. And I was lucky, I was at the drawn game, and watching Dublin's voracious appetite and hunger to try and get the ball back, to try and, first of all, engineer an equaliser, and then to try and win the game, was absolutely extraordinary at the time. And I think that's what laid the foundation for what we saw last night.
Colm Keyes was at the Jim Gavin press conference. As emotion shows, Gavin says he needs some time to think about his future. So Keyes says Gavin was more expressive, emotional, clearly satisfied than he's been in public anyway, than any of his, after any of his previous six All-Ireland final post-match press conferences, going to great lengths to name-check almost all of his extensive backroom staff and 26-man squad. On his future, he said that... Well, he was asked if this is a natural end. He said, I can't say it does feel that way for me. I haven't had those conversations with backroom support yet for obvious reasons. I will be over the next couple of weeks. You sit down with the county board. You always review it. I have a profession outside of this role I've been asked to do for Dublin. I have family commitments as well. It all goes into the mix, but it's not the time to talk about it. I've committed to next year, so we'll reflect on it. So he didn't. He certainly didn't say, I've committed to next year, so I'll be here next year. It was, I've committed to next year, and we'll reflect on it. And various interpretations.
One of the papers had spun it. When I read it...
The Mirror certainly say, Gavin a shot at six. So they've read a lot into, does this feel like a natural end? And he says, no, I can't say it does for me. Which is a fairly concrete line.
Yeah, and I was reading it, and I can, when I, you know, with the Colm Keyes quotes and that are there and elsewhere, I see something different. I don't know that it sounds that definite, you know? So I don't know, that'll be... I mean, the wheel keeps turning, and that'll be the talk over the next few days. Will he stay or will he go? And which of the Dublin, you know, I was talking to a couple of Dublin fans last night, and, you know, they were naming 7, 8, 9 players that they think will step away from the inter-county scene this year after this success.
Yeah, it was difficult to know as you looked at Cluxton doing a lap of honour, which is not a Cluxton thing to do. Was that as close as we'll get to a retirement statement?
This morning, that he did a lap of honour on his own, which I didn't see, and how unusual that was.
There's pieces everywhere, so dive in, anything that caught your eye. Mark O'Shea's talking about the game, and he says, not in the least would I begrudge this Dublin team that plays in history.
He uses the word begrudge. No. I don't begrudge. I think he uses that about 3 or 4 times, which made me wonder, did he in fact begrudge?
From Freudian.
Yeah.
He said, of the game, Mark O'Shea said, this served as a reminder of just what a special group they are. They are the ultimate whack-a-mole team. And he goes on to talk about Kerry having a very good response, but he says, Dublin played with the clarity of thought and with manic intensity, while Kerry's heads got scrambled in the second half, was his take. So that's his point on Dublin. He thought they were very impressive, really, and he's not seen the end of them in any way soon.
In Joe Brawley's piece, there's a, you know, as he tends to do, sometimes when you're reading it, he starts on somewhere and it's hard to know where he's going, but he starts on a paragraph. Some years ago, a friend of mine, Paul Bacon, went to see the super fight in Vegas between Floyd Mayweather and Ricky Hatton. Many people thought the bigger, stronger Hatton would be his nemesis. Bacon said that as soon as the bell went and the fighters moved forward, it was apparent that Mayweather was on a different planet. So it was with the Dubs.
Mm. And of course, this piece was written in Mulligan's pub upstairs. They arranged for a nice quiet place upstairs for him to write it.
Well, he used to write it in the RTE studio after games.
Well, I'll come to that in 1 second, because Declan Lynch was even writing about Joe Brawley this week in the main section. Yeah. But Mick Foley, to give you a sense of the Sunday Times coverage, 5-star Dublin go down in history. Mick Foley writes, they're great players. Kilkenny, Cluxton, McCarthy, Conor Callaghan, Brian Fenton were great. And he said as well, in fairness, Sean O'Shea, David Clifford made good on their talent. Paul Gainey maintained his brilliant form all season, and the entire team pulled together every time Dublin tried to break for home. But ultimately it wasn't enough. He said, everything about Dublin, this struck me as well, everything about Dublin looked more tuned up from the beginning. 5 shots in the first 5 minutes yielded 5 points. Talks about Kerry's decision to aim a barrage of long balls at the Dublin Square didn't produce the expected return either. After 44 minutes, he makes the point, Kerry got within one, which was very impressive. But then 2 points from Mannion, either side of O'Brien's chance, reflected the economy Kerry were still struggling for.
Shane McGrath picks it up in the Mail too, but the point about finance, which he said it's about much more than that.
Right.
You know, he talks about the sheer courage Dublin showed which was again something that we saw in the drawn game when they weren't at their best, the courage that they showed. The words he uses are vigilance and discipline, you know, and that probably summed them up very well last night.
There was a piece on Clifford you wanted to mention in the Mail?
No, there's a piece by Michael Clifford in the Mail, but it's not on the All-Ireland final itself, if you want to come back to us in a bit. Yeah, sorry. It's kind of relevant in a sense that he's talking about this hurtling towards splitting the championship into two different tiers of counties, and he makes a very good comparison with the Brexit conundrum in it. And because of my own personal, you know, distaste for the idea of a two-tier championship in the football at the moment, it stood out at me as being an excellent column and timely on the weekend that's in it, just to remind people that in a couple of weeks' time that there is going to be a very, very concerted attempt by the bigger wigs in the GA circles to enforce this on the smaller counties.
Is this thing a fait accompli? It's obviously been in the background over
it's a GA vote, you know, and
they're often fait accompli.
They are often fait accompli. Mel Clifford used the word that it feels like a legacy project, and that's very much what it does feel like. And he says that nobody is prepared to tackle the elephant in the room, which is a provincial championship, which is it's a farce at this stage. I mean, you know, when you see proposals to give Dublin a bye to the Leinster semi-final next year because they just win too many games in Leinster, and nobody is asking, is this a good idea? Connacht Championship, people say it's competitive, but it's just three teams fighting it out. Ulster Championship, Munster Championship, a joke. Just get rid of the provincial championships and start again. But the fact that they won't even consider that, and instead are trying to force something different, which doesn't make sense at the moment, on the GA, which players in the smaller counties, I can tell you, don't want. That's what the feedback from them is to the GPA and to anyone that asks them. Managers don't want it. Fans don't want it. You know, why are we? And the vote's in a few weeks, and it's. You know, it's the old thing of never call a vote unless you know what the result is going to be, which, you know, cost David Cameron badly. And
so that's Mick Clifford in the Mail.
Mick Clifford in the Mail,
going to ramp up over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, once the All-Ireland talk dies down.
Yeah, well, the final points in the All-Ireland, Colm O'Rourke's headline in his piece, "It was foolish to think it would be any different," and talks about how Dublin proved they don't have a glass chin in the drawn game. Concludes his piece by saying, "The greatest game have now enough medals between them to rival Fort Knox. They got it right this time. Starting Merchant paid off. Their best players responded. It was foolish to ever think it would be any different. Everyone played their part. They were just a better team than Kerry, and it may not change next year either." And then to segue into Declan, your piece on Joe Brawley, he's writing here on page 2 and 3, "One door closes, another one opens. I will never again watch an All-Ireland final sober," is his opening. "After 4 pints of stout, one sees the game in a deeper, more meaningful light," is how he starts. And on he goes. He says, "Clifford and O'Shea and their young teammates will most certainly win a Celtic Cross someday, but it will not be for a few years. There is a gulf between them and the Dubs in strength, endurance, skill, under pressure, adventure, selflessness, finishing. That will not be closed anytime soon." So it's interesting, Brawley and O'Rourke are both saying, this gap is very real and it ain't closing in the space of a year or two.
But at the same time, you'd see bits of that match, as I would have done, right, in which, you know, Kerry should score a goal and don't. Do you know what I mean? Like they go for a point instead. You know, very small differences, really. You know, and of course in the first game they didn't score anything for the last 13 minutes. You know, that how far behind really are they? Do you know what I mean? There's this psychological thing which is huge, and like, you know, you would have seen several points during that match yesterday where just a slightly better option or a bit more focus on just... Dublin seem to have this attitude that, like, they're playing, you know, that the points are kind of a bit of a luxury, and that, you know, they just this utter ruthlessness of going for goals, that thing of the goal straight off the into the second half, right? You know, there's a savagery of it, you know? And that's only a state of mind, really, rather than, you know, the guy being some Leo Messi or anything like that. Do you know what I mean? That is something that's, you know, can be trained and can be, it's about sort of a culture as much as anything. So you'd wonder just how far behind really other teams are. Yeah, did they just think they're further behind than they are, really?
You'd ask the question, are they closer than Mayo were in 16 and 17, or are they further away?
I feel further away, but I feel that that Mayo team were at their peak then, and this
Kerry
team
is not.
Yeah,
that's the point, and this team is on definitely on an upward trajectory. And also, I mean, the kind of conventional wisdom that Kerry had blown their chance in the replay, or in the drawing game, and that the replay would take. I mean, they went toe-to-toe to them again for a lot of the game last night, and as Declan said, it was the small margins, which, you know, ultimately separated them.
Yeah. Small margins. They're always small. I mean, there's a reason Tiger Woods can't.
Well, sometimes you have big margins.
Yeah,
sometimes they're not small margins, but in this case, I think they are, you know, or they look like it, you know.
We're taking a short break and then we're coming back to the main section of the Sunday Indo, page 16, where Declan Lynch's diary, the headline is, RTE is throwing out more here than just the great Joe Brawley. We'll come to that in just 1 second. Latest in the Premier League, 37 minutes gone. Bournemouth 1, Everton 0. Callum Wilson with the goal. We'll bring you Watford Arsenal live from 4:30. Ladies intermediate final half-time, Tipperary 1-10. Meath 1-9 is where we are in that game at Croke Park. We have the Sunday Independent sports editor John Green here in studio, and also the Sunday Independent's Declan Lynch. Declan, in between flicking over between events between Manchester City and Norwich and watching events at Croke Park, you were also writing, RTE is throwing out more here than just the great Joe Brawley. This is on page 16 of the Sunday Independent main section. Quite a few people writing about Joe Brawley across the Sunday sports pages today. Take us through your contention, your piece.
Well, it seemed to me that it's like this perfect illustration of a kind of a culture, a kind of, you know, the dead hand of corporate hackery, you know, you could describe it. I was amazed when I heard about it, right? But then I was amazed, if you know what I mean, right? Because we all know at some level that the world is now kind of run by people whose main kind of focus is to, you know, safety first. Do you know what I mean? I don't want any problems here. Keep things nice and sort of neat and tidy, and let's just, you know, get on with it, right? And, you know, people who don't fit in or things are awkward things, you know, are kind of a problem, you know? But, you know, when it actually happens, something so obviously wrong as this, right, you're still surprised. I mean, you kind of know that's how it works, and yet it still has that capacity to surprise you. And I'm not even all that invested in GAA, right? Do you know what I mean? Or even if at all, yet. But I would have always, you know, considered Brawley to be just obviously the best thing about any GAA panel, because clearly he is, right? I mean, that's just, I would say, a statement of fact, as close as you can get to it, right? I mean, I at the same time have read other articles about this which have a different point of view, including a very good one by Michael Foley in the Sunday Times. It's a good piece, and it makes an argument about, you know, how Brawley could go over the top at times, and maybe it had reached the end of a certain, you know, whatever, right? I would still disagree profoundly with it, right? Because, you know, Brawley is not some sort of dilettante or some, you know, people have this, all loud-mouthed pundits, you know, fellas shooting off at the mouth and all this, right? Like, Brawley is a very serious GAA person. He's won an All-Ireland, right? He's not some lad arriving along, throwing out a few personal insults to people and trying to get a bit of a reaction to it. You know, he clearly cares deeply about Gaelic football. It's his life, you know. He's thought very deeply about it, but his approach to it is that he will push it. Do you know what I mean? He will. People like him are, in the past, someone like Dunphy, right? They kind of live in the moment, you know, and they understand that that's what television is about, really. Do you know what I mean? It's about moments. It's about kind of, you know, taking your filter away and just, if you like, going for it. Do you know what I mean? Have instinctively reacting to things rather than thinking, how is this going to go down here, there, or wherever, and just making a nice, safe comment, right? Because that's fine. It's just boring, right? I don't want to see that. And really, nobody else does. And without these guys, without people like Brawley, I don't know if we'd even have pundits. Do you know what I mean? Why would you want to watch some of these guys? They're not interesting. They're not interesting people. They're boring. You know, they're not intelligent. They're not sort of pushing things. They're not, it's like with any, it's like a piece of writing. Do you know what I mean? Most stuff that's written is just not all that good, because partly because people aren't trying hard enough. I think there's a huge element of the difference between good and bad is just some people are just trying harder. And it's not really genius or talent. It's just some people just put more into it. And someone like Brolly is putting more into it, I would argue, and is clearly putting more into it. And to be sort of essentially given his cards on account of a disagreement or a bad call he made, which he acknowledged was a bad call afterwards, like him being right or wrong about something is not important. Do you know, if he's wrong all the time, yes, it is important. But sometimes when you do operate at that level of trying hard and trying to kind of, you know, be interesting and lively and just putting a lot into it, you are going to get it wrong. It's a live program. Do you know what I mean? You'll say the wrong thing or whatever, and you know it'll look a bit bad, right? But I would have that, you know, 365 days of the year mm-hmm. compared to the alternative. And you know, you have RTE here who are in this situation, in which, you know, they've got this crisis going on, and they're talking about selling land and reducing superstars' salaries and all this kind of stuff. And RTE is in the talent business, basically, or it's in nothing, right? It's in
the entertainment business.
Yeah, and the entertainment business. Like, yeah, it has to have an awareness that its first job is to have an awareness of talent and the nature of it and how to manage it, right? And this is kind of the antithesis of that. This is like saying, well, we don't really want it. Do you know what I mean? It's not for us. We prefer to have fellas, you know, who are, you know, going to say nothing, really.
The antithesis is Shane McGrath making the exact opposite point to Declan in the Mail today. And Shane is someone I have a lot of respect for, but I couldn't disagree more with his view on this. So he says, instant access to information has helped hasten the end of this valuable school. Viewers have never been so well informed, which is exactly the point. They have never been so well informed. So as Joe Brolly was making a point at halftime in the All-Ireland final, in which he was clearly wrong, and everybody watching him knew he was clearly wrong, he still made his point anyway. And we the viewers, can then assess that he's wrong, but we don't mind, because he's expressing an opinion one way or the other. Mm. So Shane tells us that good punditry, myself and Declan were just talking about this outside, good punditry should react to that as, for all the modesty of its viewing figures, Sky Sports analysis has done. Well, so there's the contradiction. Nobody watches Sky Sports' analysis. Nobody watches Gaelic games in Sky Sports. This is a huge
he kind of contradicts his own point there to some extent, you know.
But that's not just necessarily because of the analysis.
It's not necessarily, but
yeah, that's a habitual thing.
No, but he's making the point that there is a greater awareness of, you know, statistical analysis and this, and it's put to use by Sky, who, despite their modest viewers. So, in fact, what is the great hunger for that? You know what I mean? I never realised that there was any greater rejection of Joe Brolly. Do you know what I mean? Or of indeed Eamon Dunphy or whatever, quite the contrary. And like, I'd love to see like what the figures would be like, but not that everything should be about figures. I understand that completely, but again, in the other way, in a very good piece by Mick Foley, I mean, it's a good piece, but like he does quote statements from the past by Brolly, such as he said, you know, I intensely dislike Mickey Hart, he said, you know, it was a personal matter, right? Now that's okay, right? I think it's okay. As long as, you know, it's like this in journalism, the difference between opinion and, you know, supposedly factual journalism. What we have learned over recent times is that, in fact, the only thing you can really rely on in a newspaper is opinion stuff, because at least you know where it's coming from. This myth that factual journalism is sort of just arrives out of the air, perfectly formed, with nobody sort of interfering with it in any sense or making any choices, is just childish, right? So in fact, the only thing that you can call straightforward journalism is one that has someone's ugly face on top of it and saying, this is what I think. Mm. At least you know where it's coming from, exactly, right? So, you know, if Joe Brolly is honest enough to actually say, look, I have a personal bias about this guy, what is the problem with that? That's okay. That is journalistically, for me, fine, yeah. You know? And in fact, it's the others, it's people who don't declare their interests, if you like, and who make sort of snaky comments about people, who there aren't sort of honest enough to admit that they, you know, they have some grudge against. That's a problem. This isn't a problem.
Yeah. Well, Shane McGrath writes, in 2004, Brawley said the Mayo footballer Kieran McDonald looked like a Swedish maid because of the way he wore his hair. 15 years on, cheap insults had lost the power to shock, and the argument that he and his colleagues were obliged to entertain as well as inform was hollow. So that's, and to finish off McGrath's point, good punditry should react to things like the flood of data and stats which have come into the game, and for all the modesty of its view and vigour, Sky Sports analysis has done. So that's Shane McGrath. To give you more on Mick Foley, the headline is Brawley shoots from the lip no more. So this is kind of the key point he's making. He talks about Brawley being a compelling public character for 18 years in television and beyond, but also a potential liability onto himself. His apology to Gough was his fourth in the last 6 years after derogatory comments aimed at Marty Morrissey, Sky anchor Rachel Wise, and Tyrone footballer Sean Kavanagh. Magnify that candour through the lens of a television camera over the years, and RTE will argue that too many incidents left no choice but to stand him down yesterday. Goes on to say, it's a reminder of the Sunday game's extraordinary reach that Declan McBennett's arrival in RTE as head of sport this year, seeking more analytical rigour from his pundits and a clampdown on personal attacks, was immediately made more newsworthy by speculation over Brawley's future. That by itself, says Mick, said something about how the public had grown to see him. Brawley's an All-Ireland winning footballer, a barrister, eloquent eyewitness rather to the troubles, kidney donor and activist with insights into football worth hearing. Television gave him his widest possible audience but turned him into a cartoon bad guy or voice of the true Gael, depending on how you saw and heard him. So that's to give you a sense of what Mick Foley is saying.
I don't understand the point about his obligation to entertain. I don't think there's an obligation to entertain, but it just so happens that that RTE panel, you know, the traditional panel that we've all become used to of O'Rourke, Spillane and Brawley, like Dunphy, Giles and Brady in the soccer panel, which RTE, as Declan has pointed out many times in the past, tried for years to break up for no good reason that anyone has been able to figure out. And now, you know, the speculation is that O'Rourke and Spillane will also, you know, be moved aside to allow a new generation of pundits to come in, which is great. But who are these new generation of pundits? Because, you know, I haven't seen them.
It goes against a fundamental law of what you would call show business, right? Which is simply, you know, if something works, you hang on to it like a dying man. Do you know what I mean? Because almost nothing works. Almost nothing in the world works properly, right? And in show business, virtually nothing has ever worked, right? Almost everything fails. And if something, you had something like the RTE football panel, which was one of the most successful things ever in the history of RTE.
Yeah.
Probably one of the top three things, right? Okay? And, you know, instead of grasping it with, like, you know, the fervour of the man hanging off the precipice, you know, they seem to be working assiduously to figure out how do we stop this? I mean, it's comedy. It's just black comedy, the whole thing. And eventually they succeeded magnificently in and it's all gone now. Do you know what I mean? And what's left? So, like, it's about what we do
for a living and how interesting. Mm. We talk about the dangers that are out there for traditional media, and RTE is part of the traditional media, and so is the Sunday Independent part of it. And, you know, we are the greatest danger to ourselves, because anytime anything remotely interesting happens, there seems to be this move to try and stop it before it gets out of hand. Like, it's not about defending Joe Brawley. I'm his editor in his newspaper life, and he is a very difficult and challenging columnist because he pushes the boat out all the time and he puts it right to you in the same way that other columnists do. And that's a good thing, because he challenges you. But the fear that can spread across, and you can see it in RTE's coverage this year, there's a fear there this year, and it has been creeping into its GA coverage just as it crept into its soccer coverage. And it's really disappointing to see, because they had something good. They had a magical soccer thing. They had a magical...
Sure.
The Sunday game is a magical programme.
Should there be, when you're talking about amateur players who have to go to work the next morning, to use one of the great cliches I know, should there be a higher threshold when it comes to defending them from personalised attacks, like, say, the Kavanagh one?
Well, you can forget about him
as a man.
Yeah.
Was a really tough comment to say about somebody over a foul on a football pitch.
And
that went too far. I think, I don't know, does Brawley stand by it or not? He's perfectly entitled to if he wants to. But is there, the more general question, because I want to stress, it's not for me to be discussing RTE choices. Absolutely not.
But is there a higher threshold when you're talking about amateur sports people and how you protect them? That's one of the interesting questions. Should there be a higher threshold than when you're talking about a Paul Pogba?
I don't know. For an editorial, for me, I would always be conscious of that and allow and what we allow and what we don't allow in. But you take the David Goff one last Sunday, Sunday week that he was removed from. I mean, that was a perfectly legitimate comment for him to make at the time. And I know David Goff quite well. He's a club mate of mine. Mm. And I've spoken to him about it as it happens. And it seems to me in this instance that other people took offence on behalf of David, who didn't take offence to the comment. So I don't know about whether Sean Kavanagh took offence to it or not at the time. I know that they talk now, so I don't know. Mm. Is there a higher threshold?
I think it's very hard to generalise about something like that. You just have to take each situation as it comes. Yeah. But in a general sense of, you know, what we call the traditional media, right? The other side, do you know what I mean? The tech people, basically the most brilliant people in the world are running that stuff, right? And we need to have brilliant people running our things all the time. We need them to be making brilliant decisions more or less constantly, or we're screwed, right? It isn't just the case that all there is television and newspapers. You know, you've got these monstrosities out there now, you know, infecting the minds of the multitude with poison, right? But with, you know, brilliant people, brilliant people, you know, intellectually, morally kind of clearly, you know, deficient, but like, you know, they're very good at what they do, right? And, you know, in response, we need to be brilliant. We need to have brilliant people running media organisations. We need to have them making great decisions. And like to be, you know, presenting us with situations where like getting rid of interesting people is not really the way to do that. Okay. Do you know what I mean?
And the other point is that...
Last word on this, John. Yeah.
The other point is like what we do and what you do, Joe, and what RT does in a professional environment, and in terms of what we might say or not say about people, whether they're amateurs or professional, is a lot more tempered and a lot more thought out than what's said out in the great, you know, social media land,
sure,
where it's much more personal, much more vindictive. There has always been in this country a tradition in media of some element of control and exercising some sort of standards. Mm. You know, where that falls then, I don't know. But I mean, in any of the things where people felt Joe went too far in the past, you know, he did apologise. And as Declan pointed out at the very start of this, he said he things are said in the heat of the moment.
Yeah, no, look,
and they're right or they're wrong.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that more than most, you know, that happens. Right, I mean, it's amazing, even though he wasn't on TV yesterday, how many pieces are about him this afternoon.
It's the opening of his column today. Sorry, this is the last word on it. You know, one door closes, another opens. I will never again watch an All-Ireland final sober. I mean, if we're talking about interpreting Jim Gavin's press conference yesterday, that seems to be a very much I wonder, is it a come and get me plea to Sky?
It does read as if he's done, though.
It does,
that was my reading of it as well. Sunday Independent sports section has a wraparound feature like you did for the Camogie, which has 4 pages of coverage in the final today. There's lots in that. Fiona McHale has a very good analysis piece if you're looking for a quick summary of how this game is going to play out. Power runners and physicality holding the key to Galway's ambition is her take. Dublin are going for 3 in a row. Dennis Walsh in the Sunday Times is a brilliant piece. He talks to Joanne Cantwell, RTE's Joanne Cantwell, who was fullback on the Dublin football team. She was 16 years of age when the call came. They were a Division 3 side then in the National League. They had never even won a senior championship match. And what Dennis does here is chart how they have gone from being in that state in the late 90s to where they are now going for 3 in a row. The county once had just 8 players at training. Today they go for a third straight All-Ireland against Galway. So it's a fantastic journey they've been on. Certainly reading this, the big change has been money, for those who say that money doesn't make any difference. By the time 2014 had swung around, the women's team had been established with a permanent training base in DCU alongside the men's team. They no longer depended on the goodwill of sympathetic clubs to host their sessions. This was around the time AIG came on board as umbrella sponsors. All of a sudden they had a few bob, writes Dennis, the comfort of more to come. The girls would be fed after training. There was a nutritionist with the team. They had lots of balls and whistles that the lads would have had. AIB coming on board was huge, says one of the players, as was the move to DCU. Before that, Joanne Cantwell talks about it, about just how tough it was for them, literally having to train in car parks. I mean, Saipan, he used it as a euphemism, but they were literally training in car parks as a county team. Their bus was an hour late for the 2010 All-Ireland final. You wonder how that's possible, but here they are now. So it's a good summary, John, of a team who in the space of 15 years have gone from nowhere to the dominant force in Gaelic games.
Yeah, well, Dublin are going for three in a row today, and they're very strong favourites. And you know, it's difficult to see Galway stopping that today. But when it's easy because we can be lazy about that and then think, oh well, you know, this is all part of the Dublin dominance. And but like Dennis's piece, and to a lesser extent, Marie Crowe in our paper with Siobhan McGrath, who's playing today. It was Denise Masterson's quotes which really jumped out to me in Dennis's piece, which really kind of highlighted how stark things were. They'd never won, at one point, I think when Joanne was involved with Dublin, they had never won a match in the championship, you know, given that the ladies' football championship started in the 70s. Like, so Dublin had never won a championship match. I mean, that's where they came from. Masterson remembers a session that year when, this is in the early noughties, Masterson remembers a session that year when only eight players turned up. Burke, that was Johnny Burke, he was the manager. Burke ploughed on with a drill that he had planned with greater numbers in mind, and the players eventually asked him to stop. They didn't have enough moving parts to make it work. It was a huge low point. It was very demoralising, she says. So to go from that, I know one of the Dublin backroom team, and I met him earlier in the... Met him in probably in February and March. Just bumped into him one day, and I was asking them how they were getting on, and you know, were they back, and they were just hardly getting into it again. And like I was asking him what they were doing, and he was telling me the kind of sort of training that they were doing. It was absolutely phenomenal. What the kind of training that they were doing. So in 50, and it's not just about money, it's about being organised, but it's also about the fact that on a broader scale, I know from personal experience that ladies Gaelic football is undergoing huge growth. I mean, I think is it in Dennis's piece? It is. Yeah, there's the playing population the LGFA reckons now of about 195,000. 14,000 of them are in Dublin. So I mean, it is a, you know, it's not, there's a fairly good spread across the country. So there has been that growth, which isn't as much to do with money, but it's to do with the growth in women's sport and the fact that it's more and more women at a younger age are seeing now that they can, that there is a sport that they can graduate towards or gravitate towards. And that obviously in Dublin, that's going to be exponentially at a greater level just because of the numbers.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the interesting thing about what Dennis has done, is to just chart that progress along from literally training in a car park to getting a training base in DCU alongside the men. AIG coming in obviously made a big difference for them. But a few years ago, I was involved with an underage county team, and we were playing Dublin in an under-14 match. And after the game, they fed both teams. You know, and this was something I just at under-14 level with you know, a good spread of food. And I just thought, you know, that's what you're up against. But when you come underneath it a little bit, then they're going for three in a row today, but they at underage in the last 2 years, they haven't performed at all. So it's not just
a parallel with the men's.
No, it's not.
The quote from Joanne Cantwell of back in the day, we were looking for favours from everybody, begging clubs to allow you to use their pitches so you could train on them. I remember in the winter training in a car park at Thomas Davis GA club. We got a tracksuit once because we'd reached some sort of final, and I remember being delighted. It was just our families following us around. That was the late 1990s. So it's been an incredible turnaround to where they are now. And you've got your four pages here. Anything you want to direct someone towards?
Well, no, I think you mentioned Fiona McHale's column, which is a very intelligent assessment, just a straight assessment of the game today. And the interview on the same page with Marie Crowe, with Siobhan McGrath from the Dublin team. Again, she's been around a long time. She first played for Dublin when she was 15 or 16 as well, so she's been around for a long time, and she went away to Australia and has come back to it again. So she covers some of that ground as well that's covered by Joanne and Denise in their piece. As an interesting aside, just from a journalistic point of view, how accessible players were in the build-up for, you know, obviously we need to get access to players to produce a four-page supplement today. and just how accessible they were.
Right. We've had mixed experiences on that front, actually. Yeah. Not always as accessible as you would think, but I guess it can vary.
Yeah.
So, Fiona Kale's piece is really good. She's saying this is good. They set up very similarly, Dublin and Galway today. Their setups will have at least 12 behind the ball and then counter-attacking at pace. That's the kind of game it's going to be. So it'll all centre on who gets the upper hand in the middle and who can stop the counter-attacks.
The tricky thing for us was, because this was always planned, obviously we did the Camogie last Sunday and we did the ladies' football this Sunday, not planning on having a replay of an All-Ireland final. And so, you know, we were left with a kind of a tricky situation where we didn't know whether to proceed with the wraparound.
Yeah.
Because then, and as you pointed out, we came up with the solution of two front pages, if you like.
Yeah.
I don't know if it works or not, but we were committed to the ladies thing, and it probably does look a bit odd when you take out the sports section today and you're confronted by this image of the ladies' final. But
momentarily, you quickly figure it out.
You quickly figure it out. That's what I hope.
It's not the hardest.
You quickly figure
out
that, you know, if sports fans are intelligent, sport readers are intelligent too. But we did have a debate in the office about whether we could proceed
five in a row, you know, it's a big deal. So let's move on. There's a reason Declan Lynch came in here today, and it's not to spend the first 55 minutes talking about GAA, because when the match was unfolding at Croke Park yesterday, he was flicking frantically over to Vicarage Road to see how events were transpiring. So the Sunday Times, you have it out there. Yeah, Man City and Liverpool, contrasting fortunes. Absolutely. Talk to me.
With growing disbelief, I was watching events unfolding at Carrow Road.
I said Vicarage Road there, excuse me, Watford, Carrow Road.
No, he's recording that for later.
Hilariously, I suppose to some extent, the Sunday Times have more or less a big two-page spread on City and Norwich City and Manchester City. Mm-hmm. It's like the World Cup final. I mean, it's like a huge picture, match report and an analysis report, which... by James Gierbrandt. It's a good piece. He said, one of the most astonishing results in recent Premier League history. It barely scratches the surface of this incredible giant killing on the banks of the Wensum. Now, I never realised that the Wensum is the river that goes through Norwich. I suppose Wensum Lusum would be the line you'd take from that. But what's remarkable, like, Norwich are in the Premier League, like.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
FA Cup third round feel about this.
Yeah, they're not exactly, you know, butchers, bakers and candlestick makers. Some of them are making more than £1,000 a week, I would have thought, you know. So that they actually, you know, managed to beat City is, you know, it is still a wondrous thing. And I was watching it with that sense of, which we're all familiar with, that, like, at what point are they going to fold, like, is it a cheap suit or a deck chair? A cheap deck chair. at what point are they going to do that? But weirdly they didn't. City kind of folded like an old suit. And we're talking earlier about pundits who live in the moment and all that. I would love one to be able to say, City, they're not a good side. That's where we have to get to, you know, because I'm tempted sometimes to think they're not a great side, because partly it's that teams have now got that sense that they can't be beaten, so they just put out their reserve team. Like, Norwich had six players missing or something yesterday, right?
Injury ravaged.
Yeah, so City's defence is kind of not the best, you know, particularly with Kompany gone and with Laporte injured. You know?
It was Stones, not Amendi, who, in the piece you're referencing, he says they didn't look sure-footed throughout the game.
Yeah, but anyway, it's funny, the Sunday Times have gone completely berserk on it, like, and this is only like five matches into the season.
Match report, no. It's a big deal, they haven't beaten since January.
Yeah.
5-point lead, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it would be far too premature to make any comment except to say that the Premier League was decided yesterday.
Yes, of course. James Gierbrandt writes in that piece in the Sunday Times, as for Man City, they've now conceded six goals this season. Last year it took them until December to concede six goals.
Yeah.
Here they suffered from the absence of Laporte. They talk as well about Fernandinho. He appears to have fallen out of Pep Guardiola's preferred 11, but his defensive output in front of the back four, including brackets, whisper at his savvy ability to commit tactical fouls, sorely missed here.
He said, Norwich showed here that there is another way, that it remains possible to patch together a Premier League quality team from spare parts and broken dreams.
There you go. I think we're all fans of Teemu Pukki just now.
Is there not something with City in the Champions League week, though? Wasn't it the same last season that any time they had a little slip? that it was...
Maybe post-international break. I mean, they haven't lost in just January.
What we want to happen is that we want them to get into this sense of like, the Champions League is our big thing this year.
Yeah.
Right. Who's we?
Yeah, well, we know who we is.
All right-thinking people.
Jonathan Northcroft was at Anfield, by the way, and he talked about Origi going off in the 37th minute, and then Firmino came on. He was the instigator, the orchestrator, and the wicked difference maker as Sadio Mane moved Liverpool into a lead, which Newcastle were never going to have the weaponry to overturn. They look like they're getting better. They look like relationships are deepening, understanding is deepening. They're just having fun out there now. They were fantastic yesterday.
Yeah, it's almost disturbing.
Yeah.
I've always had this deep fear of Liverpool becoming too good.
This slump that they've had too often in seasons, not least last year when they were 7 points clear, on current form, that slump feels very far away.
Yeah, and they also have this mindset now. I mean, when the word came through that Newcastle had scored yesterday, I think a lot of us thought, how could they do that? Mm. You know, what's that about?
And it turned out it was a free goal. Yeah, there was no pattern to it.
Once you saw it, you said, well, of course, it was absurd. You know, and it was quickly corrected.
These
are errors which can be rectified almost immediately.
Is this, since, I suppose, Graeme Souness took over as manager kind of period, this must be by a distance the most enjoyable time for you to be a Liverpool fan, is it?
Yes, and almost like into this strange period where like, we now feel what, like, say Manchester United, what we felt about Manchester United. You know, this thing that they'd always win for a start, right? Mm. That no matter how a game was going, they'd find a way. You're now feeling this about Liverpool, that they have this, they know how to win, like in big matches as well. You know, they've got this strange sense now of, apart from having brilliant footballers. I mean, like Firmino. One of the biggest things this season has been, Firmino wasn't great last year, but if he continues like he started this year, I mean, Liverpool could do very well.
Mm. Are you encouraged that they have a throw-in coach now to...
I'm okay
to fall
with
back
that,
on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're talking about small margins. Maybe, possession from throw-ins is quite important. I wouldn't dismiss that
it.
Completely.
I'm not dismissing it, I'm just seeking your opinion.
There's almost nothing that comes to the mind of Jurgen Klopp that I do not
respect agree with in totality. Yeah. Before we get on to the rugby, because the World Cup is 5 days away and we'll finish on the rugby, you wanted to mention a piece Paul Roan had written about Troy Parrott?
Yeah, well, it's a good piece by Paul Roan about Troy Parrott, and I think it reflects, at least it suggests to me something that we all feel is that, for God's sake, just play him, you know. I mean, when it was suggested last week that to Mick McCarthy, maybe we should play these young lads, his response seemed to be that, the young lads are great, but for the really important matches, we need the players we can rely on. Who we know will never score, you know. So, we've had a kind of a fairly bleak time, to say the least, watching Ireland mm-hmm. for a few years, you know. And even the thought that someone like Paris could, say, make a difference against Georgia, the joy that would impart to us would be so great that it removes any of the doubts that you would have about it. And there's also some perfectly good evidence that, you know, if someone is good enough, it doesn't matter what age they are. Like John Giles and Liam Brady made their debuts for Ireland. I think they were both 18.
Yeah.
Michael Owen was 18, I think, when he astonished the world.
Yeah.
So, like, there's plenty of evidence that of young players being brilliant, mm-hmm. Regardless of being young.
They
so
were playing for their clubs at the time.
Declan's
put it very well himself today. It's only Georgia, Mick. It's only Georgia. And yet the way we are, there's a good chance of us not scoring against them. So we've worked out that it's better for a 17-year-old not to score than a 27-year-old. And anyway, we've got to make the most of the lad. As that grand old football man, W.B. Yeats, might have put it, there is no second Troy.
Very good. The Rugby World Cup starts in 5 days' time. There are...
Does it finish this year? We were trying to figure out.
November 2nd, I believe. And actually, the European Heineken Champions Cup starts 2 weeks later. So there's no rest. I mean, if Ireland, for instance, got to a semi-final and therefore had to hang around until the final for the third, fourth place playoff, then 2 weeks later, you'd be in Heineken Champions Cup action. So
if Ireland get to the semi-final, and looking across the breadth of the coverage today, and there is a lot of it, there's not many people saying that we will get to the semi-final.
No, there's very little optimism. Yeah, across the paper. So there are pieces everywhere. There is Neil Francis and Eamon Sweeney address the Minnows situation. Shane Horgan gives very good analysis of where he thinks Ireland are, and again, he has big misgivings.
Hugh Farrelly has a very good piece in the Mail where he assesses where he divides it into two: glass half full, glass half empty, and he looks at Ireland's why we should be optimistic and why we shouldn't be optimistic. And it's a good two-page spread, and he goes into a lot of detail.
Paul Kimmage, reality finally intrudes on rugby's doping fairy tale. So he's talking about the positive test of Afoui Diantie. He says that positive test should make the sport realise that it has a major drugs problem. Give us a general sense of this, John, the point Paul's trying to make about the situation.
Well, but it's... It's as it tends to be, it's a longish piece, and he's going back to a piece that he wrote several years ago with the French guy called Laurent Benizek, who took up in France the issue of what he called not so much the doping in rugby but medicalisation of the sport, and the size of
current player,
the size of the player, the ferocity of the game now, the intensity of the hits. And Paul is going back to that piece. I'm not sure when it was. I think it was around the end of 2014 he first came across that book. The Benison book was Rugby, Where Is Your Values? So then he goes on to talk about the South African rugby player. And he's, in a nutshell, he's basically saying that there hasn't been any talk about it. We're 5 days out from the World Cup and nobody is asking about how this young breakthrough player of the year was tested and found to have basically a cocktail of drugs in his system. And why it's not been addressed. Now, and this is a theme that's common with Paul across the years, not just with rugby, but with any sport, when he comes across something that suggests some level of doping and why that sport doesn't seem to be addressing it.
Well, a great example is tennis, where at Wimbledon, you can watch 2 weeks of Wimbledon, right? Hour after hour after hour. And there's two things that are never mentioned, doping and gambling, right? Tennis is like, gambling is just an enormous issue in tennis, and like doping, obviously there are stories as well. And they get through 2 weeks of wall-to-wall television without a word of it, you know. And I guess it's the same with rugby. I mean, we talked earlier about, I think if you had your Joe Brolys or more Joe Brolys on these things, you might hear more about it. Do you know what I mean? Because otherwise there's this, people just agree, look, we won't go near that, we'll sit this one out or whatever. Whereas you need your Brolys or Dunphys or whoever, you know, to kind of just push the thing a bit and mention the stuff that is kind of unmentionable.
Yeah.
So
I think this is a tricky one because you're the sports editor, you're the Sunday Independent. We get referenced in this. I could certainly get referenced in this.
He references the paper review from two weeks ago.
Any defense of me here or anything I have to say about it is just self-serving. And I don't want to get into some public thing with Paul Kimmage. We can talk about it at some stage when we bump into each other. But certainly he heard us talking about it on the paper review 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And it was All-Ireland final day with Kieran Cronin and Michael Verney. David Walsh had written about it in the Sunday Times. That was where I first really heard about this. And we most certainly did talk about it, most certainly didn't read the Sunday Times and say, well, we can let that slide. Yeah. It did come up on the show. The paper review is a part of Off the Ball. So I stand over the fact that we talked about it. We absolutely did. And then his point is that it wasn't brought up, for instance, with Keith Wood the following night. To a point, I'd accept that as a fair enough criticism. But by the same token, we have talked about this plenty of times. And like, we've talked about it, for instance, in October 2018 when the South African under-18s Craven Week, which is like their NFL combine equivalent, was happening, and some of the figures from drug testing came out and they were worrying. We discussed it at length with Keith Wood and Eddie O'Sullivan that night. I remember it. And honestly, I mean, you bring it up with Keith, say, the next night. I mean, we can do it again. I think the conversation there is a rinse, wash and repeat where we say, look, we don't know exactly what's going on. We all agree doping is bad and the sport must do more. I mean, we talked about it in our editorial meetings here, and the sense was, well, why don't we talk to someone in South Africa about it and try and get someone on from South Africa who can fill in the blanks about Deontay, about what's going on down there. That was our sense, to be honest with you. I don't think I don't think Monday night and Wednesday night rugby, where we often have Irish former players on, I don't think that's a good forum for loose conversation about this. Because you still are talking about doping, reputations at stake. It's not something to be casual about. You need very informed guests on this. You need to set a very high standard for this type of conversation. It's not a place for loose opinion. Me as a presenter, if I'm going to talk about it on the Monday, I want to be really on top of the subject matter. I don't want to be loosely asking Keith, what do you make of this? Do you reckon they're all doping? I do, yeah. Grant, sure, they probably are. That's not how it's going to go. That's not how it's going to go on the show. That's not how I'm going to do it. And I didn't, I mean, by Monday, I wasn't on top of this enough to get into it. I didn't feel talking to Keith about it was the best thing to do. So, I mean, look, you can absolutely take the criticism on the chin and we should really talk about it. But we did talk about it on the Sunday. Like, if you're going to have a pot, like, we did address it. We did highlight this. But I think you have to choose your guests wisely in this area. And we have talked to Keith about doping before, back in October after Craven Week. We have had Brian O'Driscoll in the chair you're in prompt, I would say, a worldwide discussion on painkiller use in the sport. We have covered the Gerbrand Grobler thing ad nauseum when it cropped up. So, look, I don't even like getting into this because it just seems completely self-serving.
I take
the criticism to a point. You could absolutely have brought it up with the pundits he mentioned. Equally, I'm just not so sure that's the best way to do it. And again, this will sound like an excuse, but it was one of those two-week periods which has been insanely busy. And more of my reading was on Roy Keane's autobiographies and Gary Neville's autobiographies and trying to do justice to a show. And that was the focus of a lot of our attention than rather having the time to really get stuck into this. Because I think if you're going to cover it, you have to get stuck into it. Alan Quinlan's piece yesterday, very good. I mean, they're all comment pieces. They don't move it on as such. And that's kind of the standard we might try and pitch at when it comes to this. Could we have talked about it on the Monday? For sure. Will we absolutely talk about it again? 100%. I didn't want to get into talking about this on air.
The reference to Off the Ball, he does go on, patience being a virtue, we sat and waited some more. After the Off the Ball thing, he moves into the wider media, including our own in-house, including Independent, the Sunday Independent, Irish Independent, Independent.ie. O'Driscoll, nothing. O'Gara, nothing. Gordon Darcy, nothing. Donal Lenihan, nothing. Stuart Barnes, nothing. Lawrence Dallaglio, nothing. Matt Williams, nothing. Liam Toland, nothing. Luke Fitzgerald, which is with the Independent, nothing. Until finally it was Quinlan who stepped up to the plate. South African rugby has had a problem with doping for years, going right back to my playing days, he wrote yesterday in the Irish Independent.
Mm. Yeah, Rose Case was good.
So, you know, his point, I think, while, you know, obviously your focus is on what he says about Off the Ball, it's a much wider point in terms of all of us in the media, including the Sunday Independent, the Irish Independent, the Irish Times, the Examiner. You look across the papers today, this is the big set-piece day for the Rugby World Cup. Mm. It's the Sunday before the first. South Africa are playing next Saturday. Nobody's addressing it. Nobody's addressing what's going on here. What is the story with this with this guy?
Well,
that's the broader point. I understand that there's a specific...
It will be interesting watching the World Cup. There'll be like 6 weeks now of the World Cup, right?
Seems like it's been a lot more.
Is it 6 weeks? Yeah. And it'll be just at the end of all that, right?
This team is the favourite, is many people's favourites to win the World Cup.
Yeah.
But most of the pundits today seem to be tipping South Africa in the... Is it the Sunday Times to... everyone picking South Africa seems to be the one that, even though this is the most open World Cup in years.
Mm. Well, to reiterate the situation again, the story again, this guy won the Breakthrough Player of the Year. He scored 2 tries against New Zealand last year, and in July when he was tested, the South African Institute of Drug-Free Sport, they found 2 anabolic steroids in his system and an androgen receptor modulator detected in his sample. That was on August 24th. So again, absolutely, it's a huge story. Of course it is. Yeah. But I mean, like, how do you move it on? Like, what do you talk about? You find out more about what's going on in South Africa would be my sense. But I take his point to a point. So that's it addressed with. I'm sure we'll come back to it at some stage.
There is,
Paul's more than welcome to come on and talk about the story on the show at any stage.
Like, obviously, across all the papers, there is a lot of rugby today.
Yeah, there's a
lot. But I mean, I don't know what you thought, but there's almost a kind of a sense that of holding back almost, because this is a marathon, it's not a sprint.
Mm.
Although there's an under a current air of worry for Ireland going into this World Cup across all the papers, that we're going in on a downward trajectory after the highs of last year.
Well, that is far preferable, surely, than going in
with our normal
themselves, you know. that never works.
Yeah. It hasn't worked well for us before. Yeah.
There's also been 6 weeks of build-up, really, you know, and previewing, and I think it would be a relief when the whole thing gets started. Fellas, we're pretty much done. So, Declan Lynch, thanks very much for coming to the studio. And John Green, thanks as well. Appreciate it, John.